You are listening to CFRO 102.7 on your FM dial. Good afternoon and welcome to Animal Voices. This show is presented through the cooperation of three local groups, Animal Defense and Anti-Vivisection, Earth Save Canada, and the Vancouver Humane Society. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of these organizations. My name is Marge Adams. And in the studio with me is co-host and technician for the day, Allart, and our regular contributor, John Pranger. Our other two regular contributors, Alan and Carl, are either out of town or otherwise engaged. We have two guests calling in today. First, Deborah Probert, Executive Director of the Vancouver Humane Society, who will be telling us about the ongoing Chicken Out project. And later in the hour, Allart also has a guest called Neil Boyd. Will you tell us just a bit about that interview, please?
Sure. Neil Boyd is a criminologist professor at SFU. Last week, I talked about the sordid world of dogfighting. And so we're going to ask some questions about that of Neil and also talk about the breed-specific legislation and some other laws with regards to animals.
Aha, I'm sure it'll be very interesting. Now, we as well on the show as those two interviews, we're going to have a little music now and again, a few animal jokes, and other items of interest. So that it should be a pleasant hour, I would think. And while we're waiting for our first guest to call in, I'll start off with a couple of jokes. Here's one. Pet hamster care, it's called. After buying her children a pet hamster, after which they had promised that they would take care of it, Mom, as usual, ended up with a responsibility. One evening, exasperated, she asked them, "How many times do you think that hamster would have died if I hadn't looked after it?" After a moment, her youngest son replied, "Once?" I think our guest is on the line. Am I right?
Yep.
Okay. Hi, Deborah, are you there? Can you hear me? No, I don't think so. Hello, Deborah?
No, we lost her. I guess she'll have to call back, so continue on with your story then.
Oh, okay. So that was my first joke about the children not looking after the animals, which is very common, isn't it? They have good intentions, but it doesn't quite work out. Now, how are we doing?
Yeah.
Good. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, Marge. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine. We're just having a little bit of trouble here getting the hookup properly done. Now, thank you so much, Deborah, for being with us this afternoon. It's always nice to have you on the show.
Thank you, Marge. It's nice to be here.
Good. And I know that things have been progressing well with the Chicken Out campaign, and that's what we want to hear about. Maybe, though, you could start with a little bit of background about the project.
Well, the project started about 2002. We started trying to focus our efforts to have the most effect on suffering of animals. And what we decided to do was to go after egg-laying hens. Egg-laying hens spend their entire productive lives of about a year in tiny little cages crammed together. Their beaks are cut off. The conditions are very horrible. They're in barns with toxic air. They can't move. They can't even flap their wings. And they have no access to any kind of natural substrate. They never see the sun. They never feel fresh air. They just really have a terribly deprived existence. So what we decided to do with the Chicken Out Project was to try to make people see and understand just how these animals live and that there are alternatives and they don't have to live that way.
I remember how you used to suffer when you drive in behind a chicken truck sometime on the highway. And you were just in agony thinking of the wretched lives those poor little creatures endured.
Yes, I still am. Those chicken trucks are still coming through, and it drives me crazy. But at least I go to the office and I start working on it with Bruce and with the other people here at VHS. And it's a very good feeling to know that things are progressing.
Absolutely, yeah. And now, I know there's been a tremendous amount of work go into this, and that's 2002 it started, and just continuous effort on the part of so many people involved with VHS, I know. Now, you have got a lot of response, very positive response from companies and institutions. Maybe you could just tell us about a few of those, could you?
Yes, we've had a great deal of success in Canada. The schools include, these are where eggs from caged hens have been removed. Langara College, BCIT, and Crofton House School have dramatically reduced consumption of eggs from caged hens. The University of Guelph, UBC, and the University of Toronto.
Wonderful.
And we're also working with Simon Fraser and a number of other smaller colleges. To BCIT is another one we're working with, and it's looking very, very good.
Amazing, isn't it?
Yes,
it seems to be the time is ripe, and it's happening so quickly. Also, cities.
Yes, there are a number of cities that have gone. The cities of Richmond, Vancouver, and now the big news today is Whistler have all passed resolutions requesting municipally run facilities to use cage-free.
Wonderful.
Eggs. So we're really, really thrilled.
And those three are particularly significant, aren't they?
They are significant. I mean, everybody knows that Vancouver is a very progressive place and Greater Vancouver is very progressive. But we need these victories to show the rest of Canada that it can be done. Industry is always saying that they can't meet the demand. In fact, they can meet the demand, and we're very, very excited about it.
And this will have some impact on the 2010, won't it?
Well, I think that with the world looking at us, I think that it's excellent that we're able to use that at the time. We're certainly working on initiatives that will take advantage of the fact that the world is looking at Vancouver to bring up the fact that it is a very, very humane city in terms of particularly this kind of issue, farm animal issues. and we will use whatever we can to get our chicken out there, and hopefully she'll be on international television in 2010.
You're talking about Henny right
yes.
now, aren't you? That wonderful big chicken that's a mascot for
yes, and I can tell you that she is famous. I've attended conferences in places like Washington, D.C., where people have come up to me and said, well, you know, I was in Vancouver a few weeks ago, and I saw this giant chicken downtown. So she is definitely making a difference, and people do recognize her.
Good. Now, will these commitments that cities and institutions have made, will they impact very soon on the hens? And if so, how?
Well, our goal, obviously, is to get rid of battery cages, and the demand, changing the demand for eggs from cheap eggs to eggs from hens that are not caged is going to make a huge difference. It's going to get the hens out of cages, and that's our initial goal. Of course, we'd all like to see eggs not being used at all, but we know that everybody on the planet, almost, except for a few people, mm-hmm. do still consume eggs. So if we can get them to consume eggs that are less inhumane, I think we're making a big step. So this is going to make a huge difference. It's going to create a demand for eggs that are from hens that are not in cages, and it's going to change the way farming is carried out in BC and in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
We do monitor the agricultural journals, and we are seeing industry who, as I mentioned before, have been saying, no, we can't do that, we can't meet the demand. Now they're talking about, well, we have to meet the demand, it's there, and we've got to change.
Uh-huh. Now, when a city passes a motion, or I don't know whether it becomes a bylaw automatically, but is it then monitored in any way by the city itself to make sure this is happening?
Well, they're actually not laws. They're recommendations or requests.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the municipalities have put in place a clause where they're going to reexamine it in a year and see how successful it's been. And we, of course, will be on their case to actually carry that out and to show that it is in fact working. I think that one of the initiatives that we've been active in, along with the Humane Society of the United States and their sister organization, HSI Canada, Bruce Passmore has been working with the suppliers, and that's a very important initiative, because this way when we go to the city, we know that they can access the product. And Bruce has been working with the suppliers. He's been to Toronto a couple of times and met with suppliers, and they are very, very keen.
They are. Wonderful.
It's really exciting. So things are going very, very well, because we're dealing with everything along the chain where it's effective.
Yes, and cage-free, I think that is not a really firm, hard definition of animal freedom, is it?
No, we unfortunately, cage-free is a bit vague, and we left it that way purposely. As I say, the initiative to get them out of cages is the first step. Cage-free includes free run and free range, which are not very well regulated. And, of course, we do stress to everybody that we speak to that certified organic have the highest welfare standards. And we tell people there still are problems with certified organic, but we do make it clear that certified organic are the highest welfare. But I think initially all we can expect, if we want to have success, if we want to make any progress at all, we have to go cage-free.
Yes, I see. Now, you mentioned organic, and John wants to know how many organic producers are there? Is it pretty limited in BC, for example?
Well, in BC, there are quite a few organic producers. I actually can't tell you off the top of my head how many, but I can tell you that I shop in a number of different locales, and I am now, particularly in the last 2 years, seeing certified organic eggs in almost every store. The large stores like Safeway, Walmart is thinking about carrying them. There's access to them everywhere. So there must be a number of certified organic producers. The Egg Marketing Board is also now producing, well, they are producing certified organic eggs under their umbrella, which is very important because they hold all of the quota for BC.
Yes.
So it's growing every day. The demand is growing, and along with the demand, the supply is growing. So it's wonderful.
Yeah, and that's what a consumer of eggs should look for, certified organic, not just organic, but certified organic.
Organic will be certified, but absolutely. Look for certified organic, and you can find it in your store. There's no question. If you can't see it, ask for it, and it's there. It's in almost every store. It's in every store that I've been in the last 2 years.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's one way that our listeners can help is by looking for that designation. What other things would you suggest that people can do to help the Chicken Elk Project?
Yes, people can. There's a lot of things they can do. They can watch our website, either the www.chickenout.ca website, or www.vancouverhumanesociety.bc.ca for updates as to where they can write letters. We had a tremendous number of letters go in, particularly to Richmond, and they had a huge effect. It was really, really gratifying.
Uh-huh.
They can do that. They can get on our email alert list. Again, they can do that through our website, and we'll update them on what's going on and what they can do. They can also approach their own cities or municipalities, and it's always better if someone that lives in a municipality approaches their own government and ask what their city is doing about this and inform their politicians that this is a very easy thing for them to do. It's a choice that we make as consumers, and municipalities can make it as well. And, of course, copy Vancouver Humane Society and let us know, and we can certainly help you out. We also have stickers available. They're wonderful little pink Chicken Out stickers that you can put everywhere that is legally accessible, of course. And we'd love to send out some of those and get them out around the city. We hand them out at events like the Vancouver Sun Run and those kinds of things, and they're all over the place. So that's always helpful because it refers people to the website.
Oh, so there is a number of things that can be done in order to help. I know Bruce is very, very enthusiastic, and he suggested that he would be willing to help anybody who's working on the project.
He will, and I'd like to really give kudos to our supporters because we were able to hire Bruce because our supporters see this as something important and they support us financially, and it has been absolutely incredible the work that Bruce has done. He is a gem. He works extremely hard. He's very effective. He's very, very good with people, and he has been a major motivator in this campaign. And we can't do it without our supporters. People have to pay their rent, and they have to eat. So we're very, very happy that our supporters have seen the value in having somebody on this campaign really 24/7. I can tell you he thinks about it all the time, even when he's not here working.
I think you can back that up. He's an outstanding worker and wonderful leadership he's offered to this project.
Absolutely.
Outstanding.
And without him, I don't think it would have gone nearly as far as it has. So we're just so grateful to have him and so grateful to our supporters for helping us with this project because it is going to make a difference to millions of animals.
Yep. The number of chickens is enormous, isn't it?
It's 26 million in Canada alone at any given time, yes.
Wow. Yeah, that would be a lot of suffering removed if we got these real success on this.
Yes.
So I won't keep you. You've got a lot of things to do, I'm sure, Deborah. But thank you so much for being with us today. We really appreciate knowing the progress of this project. It's nice to have good news, you know.
Oh, it's wonderful. I tell you, it's sure wonderful here.
Good.
Thank you, Marge.
Oh, thank you again. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You have been listening to an interview with Deborah Probert, who is the Executive Director of the Vancouver Humane Society. And this is CFRO 102.7 FM. Okay, we just have a short time before the next person will call in, so maybe we could have a little joke. How about this one? This is called Deer Crossing. A crew of highway maintenance workers was sent to repair some road signs that vandals had knocked down in a forest area. The first one they put back up was a symbol warning of a deer crossing.
As they moved down the road to repair the next sign, one crew member looked back and spotted a deer crossing the highway. Turning to his co-worker, he said, "I wonder how long he's been waiting to cross."
Okay, I think on that note, Marge, how about a little bit of music here?
Thank you.
Okay, nice. Now this cut, I think you'll enjoy. It's delightful. It's by Christine Lavin, and it's called Amoeba Hop.
Puddle of muddy water left there after the rain. I got down on my knees, I looked close, I saw things I couldn't explain. There was all these itty bitty teeny weeny little tiny creatures swimming and slashing about. I put my ear down to that puddle, I could hear one of them shout, "We're going to the amoeba hop, everybody gonna be there." Got my eye on a cute paramecium, you know the one with the wavy hair, rocking and rolling, shaking ourselves and flapping up flagella all over. Well, the good times don't never gonna stop when you go to the amoeba hop. That's what I heard. I mean it. Then I spied a sharp protozoan swinging all by himself. He was looking for a partner to shake a leg with, but everyone was dancing with everybody else, so he was so lonely till Mother Nature showed him what to do. He boogied down, he did a little binary fission, split himself in two, and now he's got a partner for the amoeba hop. Everybody gonna be there. My oh, nucleoli, have you ever seen such perfect pair? Rocking and rolling, shaking their cells, slapping their cilia all over. Well, the good times don't never gonna stop when you go to the amoeba hop. Good times don't ever gonna stop when you go to the amoeba hop. Some folks think that one-celled animals don't know how to swing. People who say that are wrong, 'cause I saw a band of algae get up there and sing.
When the red robin comes bob-bob-bobbing along,
but to them it's a monster song. And the bunga was jumping, so was I. I guess I lost my head. In my excitement I splashed it dry. Oh my God, I thought they was dead, but no, they just come splashing down right here into my hand. And sure enough, I could still hear that swinging algae band sing. We're going to the amoeba hop, everybody gonna be there. Got my eye on a cute bear museum. Oh, look at the hair, girls, look at the hair. Rocking and rolling, shaking ourselves, slapping through the party all over. Well, the good times don't never gonna stop when you go to the amoeba hop. Good times don't never gonna stop when you go to the amoeba hop.
Oh, thank you for that, Allert. This is CFRO 102.7 on your FM dial, and the program is Animal Voices. Now we have another interview coming up. Allert?
Yes, we have Neil Boyd, who is a professor and associate director of the School of Criminology at Simon Fraser University. He's been educated in psychology also at the University of Western Ontario and in law at Osgoode Hall Law School. He's a previous director of the School of Criminology and the author of 5 books, and those books cover subjects of legal and illegal drugs, murder, aggression, why men are violent, and even feminism. He's also written a couple of textbooks and many academic articles. He's a frequent media commentator on subjects related to criminology, specifically drug law and policy and issues of criminal violence and homicide. He's been around. Anyways, we're going to talk to him a little bit about a variety of things, starting with this subject of dogfighting. Let me just bring you on the air. Hello, Neil.
Hi.
Thank you for coming on the air.
I enjoy it. Thanks.
Last week I did a report on the subject of dogfighting, the sordid world, what goes on in that world. And I'm wondering if you have any insights with regards to the kinds of minds that enjoy this blood sport.
Well, I think one of the things we know about people who are very serious violent offenders is that you often look for cruelty to animals, but that's one of the key indicators in adolescence, that particularly young boys, young men who exhibit cruelty to animals are of course, often people who exhibit cruelty to other human beings. And so many classification schemes in terms of assessing violence look at that history of cruelty to animals as an important indicator of future violence.
And so when we've got this Michael Vick case that has just been in the news with the dog fighting ring. So do you know, has he had a history of violence towards animals in his childhood or anything before getting involved in this as an adult?
I really don't know the specifics of Michael Vick. I think it's kind of interesting that, the reaction against what he did, I suspect that 30 or 40 years ago, the reaction wouldn't have been as strong, and I think that says something about the evolution of our society in terms of treatment of animals, that we've come some distance over the past three decades in terms of understanding that the treatment of animals is very important, and people who treat animals badly, by extension, are typically people who will treat others badly.
This is true. And do the people who tend to commit these violations, they must like it? Yes?
Well, I'm not so sure. They're often very angry, controlling people, and I guess they enjoy it. There are lots of intelligent people who pay money to watch one man batter another bloody, so it seems to me that and they enjoy that kind of blood sport, so it seems to me logical that there are going to be people who enjoy, for whatever reason, the prospect of dogs doing that to each other. If there are people who enjoy watching human beings do that to each other, I find both spectacles a little disturbing, but obviously there is a market for this kind of so-called entertainment.
And would you say that, it seems that it's primarily a male attention getter.
Oh yeah, I don't think there's any doubt that if you look at the history of violence in our culture and in every culture in the world, it's essentially the history of male violence with a few notable exceptions. But if it wasn't for men, we wouldn't really have much of a problem with violence in our culture. I think that's actually an understatement. And of course, when you look at something like dog fighting, you're not going to find a lot of women at these events cheering on the killing. You're going to find almost exclusively a male audience, as you do for something like boxing. Women go, but they go with men who are interested. And for the most part, it's men who find the spectacle of one man trying to knock another man unconscious an interesting activity.
Are you familiar with the term Schadenfreude?
Yes. Refresh my memory.
Well, Schadenfreude, it's a German word.
Yeah.
Schaden meaning misery or sorrow, and Freude being joy.
Yeah.
So it's that people who get joy,
right,
out of witnessing another's misery.
Yeah.
And there was some studies that were done some time ago where they hooked up men and women to electrodes. And they showed them each images of suffering animals or people. And in the women, it lit up the empathy centers of their brain. But in men, it lit up the pleasure centers of their brain, which I found stunning.
I hope it wasn't exclusive. All men responded that way. I'm not surprised to learn that men and women would react somewhat differently. I think men have more of a problem with violence, if you like, and more of a biological tendency towards violence than women do. I mean, hence the reason to take it so seriously as an issue in our culture and to try to create environments which support alternatives to male violence and alternatives to sport that essentially have violence as the centerpiece.
Yeah, I'm wondering, though, with certainly the males that did respond this way with it hitting the pleasure centers, I wouldn't say that it would be this case for all males, but certainly the amount of men that it did hit their pleasure centers, well, when I look at the world and all the violence going on with it, not just the dog fighting, but the wars and the power struggles and the corporate takeovers and all this kind of stuff, I begin to, with looking through it, through those lenses, so to speak, I get to wonder, do these people just really like warring about everything and playing king of the heap about everything?
Well, yeah, I think there has to be cultural encouragement, too, for that kind of behavior, and there is plenty of cultural encouragement, of course, for male aggression and male violence, and that's a problem, too. You know, at the same time, I'm not going to take the position that competitions are a bad thing. I mean, No. Politics is, of course, a competition of ideas, and I think that that's a healthy it's a healthy exercise, of course, as you say. Mm-hmm. When you look at the reality, you know, there's all too quick a resort to war and to conflict, you know, even sort of nasty verbal conflict. So it's pretty disappointing when, you know, as somebody who grew up in the late 60s and early 70s and couldn't imagine that the world would turn out quite the way it has with somebody like George Bush in the White House and Stephen Harper and as the Prime Minister of Canada and kinds of values that they appear to have, it's quite disturbing. If you had told me 30 years ago that this would be happening in 2007, I wouldn't have believed you.
Yeah, that's true. And of course, when you say if it's socially condoned, then of course it tends to be more prevalent. But when it's not socially condoned, as in the case of dog fighting or any of these other dog-hog fighting, all these blood sports, when it's not socially condoned, it's then driven underground. And so it doesn't go away. It just manifests out of sight.
Yeah, I think we're always better to you know, to express outrage and derision at that kind of activity. I think one, as I said earlier, I think one of the healthy developments of the last generation is that something like dogfighting is seen as a reason to expel somebody from the NFL and to prosecute him and to put him in jail, and that kind of cruelty to animals. And I, you know, if you look back on case law 30 years ago, that animals didn't seem to have the kinds of rights that they do today. So I think we've come a long way there, and I think I'd like, you know, I think the real test of change is actually in what there is cultural support for. You know, we can see this probably most clearly with something like racism. Racism in the United States was socially acceptable 50 years ago. It's socially unacceptable. You couldn't get elected to any office if you espouse racist views, and that's really healthy. So, you know, to the extent that we can see the rights of animals as more and more important over time, and, you know, the actions of Michael Vick are regarded with the kind of revulsion that people seem to regard them, I think those are the key things. We have to look at attitude changes. I guess what I find disturbing is that there's still a lot of support for people and viewpoints in political life that really aren't going to be very helpful. And, of course, I'm thinking of the current leadership in North America.
Yes. And speaking of, you know, the attitude change even just towards people with the racism, now we have this breed-specific legislation that's going on. To me, it just seems like it's almost a racist kind of a thing, only it's applied now to breeds. Breed-specific legislation for our listeners is a legislation that's come in to ban specific breeds of dogs or to restrict them heavily, and primarily the pit bull, Rottweilers are targeted with this. So what do you know about this breed-specific legislation, Neil?
Well, I think we had a student who wrote her MA thesis on breed-specific legislation. I must confess that when I initially encountered it, I thought, well, come on, there are genetic differences. And, of course, there are genetic differences across dogs. Some have a predisposition to more aggression than others. But the key is that if you look historically, you'll find times when German Shepherds were regarded as extremely dangerous dogs. And the idea that this is the solution, breed-specific legislation, it's really in how people treat dogs. I mean, why are pit bulls being singled out? Because, of course, if you start to think about many of the people who seek out pit bulls are drug dealers who want them for protection, and people who treat them badly because they want nasty, violent dogs, and so they have an image of a pit bull as that. Can you create a pit bull that is totally trusting? Sure. So I don't think breed-specific legislation is the way to go. On the other hand, I think it's naive to believe that the tendency of to use a recent example, a golden doodle, a hybrid breed, to be aggressive is as great as the tendency of a pit bull to be aggressive. I think that's naive. I mean, we know that there are differences, genetic differences across human beings with respect to tendencies and with respect to personalities and so forth. And to find differences across breeds with respect to personalities isn't particularly surprising. But I think breed-specific legislation is the wrong way to go. The more important issue, again, is, you know, getting people to think about how they're treating dogs and what purposes they want dogs to fulfill. And people who want dogs to act as vicious guard dogs are, you know, not people we want to own dogs.
No, and the problem really comes down to, it's not really the dog, as you say, it's the people who own the dogs and how they're treating them. Because certainly, for example, pit bulls, if they're taken and they're turned into fighting machines, well, then of course they can be quite violent. They tend to be violent only to other animals, not so much to humans in the research that I've studied.
That's right. I mean, I think that's still a problem if you've got a fairly, that's where I see it as you know, a situation that you really don't want to encourage, having a lot of pit bulls and golden retrievers, to use one example, because I agree there's not much evidence at all that pit bulls will necessarily be violent towards other human beings, but they have a natural tendency to be very aggressive towards other dogs. And so, you know, for the owners of dogs that are relatively docile, this isn't a good thing.
Well, that may be true, but there's also on the thing I don't understand then is because the pit bulls have been tested on the temperament scales, mm-hmm. and they score one of the highest scoring dogs. They're 83.9%, I think it is, for temperament, which is higher than, you know, labs, golden retrievers,
yeah.
All these supposedly friendly dogs. So, you know, they've been used in search and rescue. They've been used as therapy dogs.
I agree with all that. I think just that if there is conflict between dogs, you know, you've got to watch out for pit bulls because of the strength of their jaws. It's just you're dealing with a different proposition than you are with other dogs.
Yes, I guess that's true. Although, again, now with this... Again, it's just to me. It still comes back to, and, you know, down to the owner,
and that
owner can certainly train that dog to behave itself around other animals too.
No, I think that's true. I just, you know, I guess my caution is again around believing that every dog is equal in terms of its potential for harm if in the event, you know, if that happens. I mean, just, it's, again, speed, size, and strength are variables with humans. Speed, size, and strength are variables with dogs.
Of course. Now, with this breed-specific legislation, which seems to be on the rise around the world, and they're targeting these specific breeds, and it's going on in Germany, Australia, England, and France, as well as here, how much of Canada, I know Ontario has this breed-specific legislation. Is that throughout Canada, or just...
No, it's not. Ontario is really the jurisdiction that's taken the lead, and you know, there've been many criticisms of it. I think it's very much an open issue as to whether that's the best approach to take. I've been convinced that it's not a particularly useful approach to take with respect to dealing with the problems that problems of dog aggression, if you like.
Yes, and now it's also been said that it's with this breed-specific legislation, it's giving powers to the authorities to come into a person's home and search and seize a dog and people who have their longtime, you know, companions of these animals. They can have those animals can be taken away from them, and they can be put to death, or they can be given to animal research shelters or the pound, or they have to give them away to somebody out of state in order to keep them alive. I mean,
yeah, I think there are, of course, when if an animal, regardless of the breed, does very significant harm, there are going to be powers of search and seizure. But to have those powers of search and seizure dependent merely on the existence of the breed is totally inappropriate.
That's true, and I also read here in this legislation that they're putting the onus of the proof of the breed of the dog on the person who owns the dog. So if they have a mix that is part pit bull, or maybe they don't even know what the mix is, but maybe it looks like it might be part pit bull or one of these restricted dogs, that the onus is on them to prove it. That seems to be unconstitutional. It would seem that the prosecution would be the ones, the onus is on them.
Well, especially when you think of the dramatic, or drastic rather, consequences that could befall the dog in the event that a decision of that kind is made.
Yes.
It could be lead to the death of the dog.
Exactly. And so what does this say about our authorities, or about, you know, Michael Bryant, the Attorney General, who's behind this bill, that he's allowed to get away with foisting his bill upon everybody?
Well, I think, you know, the key here is to look at the science and to find out what the evidence actually is with respect to breeds and what the history is. And when you start to look at the history, it becomes very interesting, because you recognize that, you know, from one culture to the next, the dog, the specific dog that has been seen as a threat and as a violent dog, has changed. And that should tell us a good deal about how it's not so much the breed as it is the culture and how people regard certain dogs. That's most important in determining some of these outcomes. But as I say, I mean, I think the key is for people to try to confront breed-specific legislation with evidence that suggests that it, you know, why it's not appropriate.
And has there been moves to try to get breed-specific legislation in all the other provinces in Canada?
Not a lot. You know, to varying degrees. Of course, some of the smaller provinces, it's just not on the radar, really. But in BC, there hasn't been that much interest, really, or support. I think Ontario is, to my knowledge at this point, is the only province where you have that clear action being taken.
Yeah. It strikes me as there's something really wrong with the idea of banning any kind of breed of dog. It's almost like saying, if I had my way, I would drive them to extinction, as if anybody has the right to do that to any other creature on this planet.
No, I think that's true.
I'm sorry?
I agree. I mean, I think that's true. Yes.
Yeah. What would you suggest that people do if they want to fight this in Ontario, or fight this, support the people of Ontario, or protect their own animals from the encroachment of this should it come our way?
Well, I think you need to look at the evidence. And so one piece of evidence I'd suggest that people look at is an MA thesis that was done in the School of Criminology by a woman named Nikki Hewitson. It's a very well-done look at breed-specific legislation. I think that, you know, too often in political life we get involved in confrontations that don't have a lot of thought behind them and a lot of science. And so I guess I would direct people there. And direct people to the scientific literature on the basis or the lack of basis for breed-specific legislation, because, feeling that it's not right is one thing, but explaining to others why it won't work, I think, is most important.
Well, this is true. And was all of that done to Michael Bryant before
I put this together? I presume not, but I don't know well enough the recent history of what has happened in Ontario with respect to that legislation.
Uh-huh. It certainly says something about our consciousness that we would go this way. I mean, we certainly wouldn't say that because in the recent news of the homicide murder that took place in Oak Bay with Peter Lee and all the warning signs with him, and because he's Asian and because there are Asian gangs, and we wouldn't sit there and say, well, therefore we got to ban all Asians.
Right.
I mean, it's as ludicrous to say that as it is to say, well, therefore now we're going to ban all pit bulls.
No, I think you're probably right about that.
Mm-hmm. And as regarding penalties for things like dog fighting rings or using dogs in cruelty to animals, what kind of penalties are out there? It seems that they're kind of lax.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think when you're sending people to jail for a year or two or three for engaging in dog fighting and for cruelty to animals involving the killing of dogs, that's a pretty substantial penalty. I have no problem with the idea that that penalty could be increased, because I think, you know, the penalties in our culture, criminal penalties in our culture, should be most substantial for those who inflict harm on others, and whether the other in this case is a human being or a dog, you know, the same kind, you as a human being, if you commit that kind of act, you're posing the same kind of threat to the culture, albeit, you know, somewhat more serious, I suppose, one would argue, of course, with human beings, but nonetheless, I think imprisonment for something like what Michael Dick did is appropriate. You know, whether you're going to get much more in the way of preventive benefit by increasing that 1 or 2 years with his likely sentence to 4 or 5 or 6 or 8, I think that's more. I think the jury is pretty much out on that. I'm not sure that adding a lot of years to the imprisonment will necessarily improve the preventive effectiveness. Most people don't want to risk going to jail at all. On the other hand, you know, to the extent that if that became a major kind of social problem and there were a lot of people engaging in that, you'd have to rethink it. But I think the overwhelming majority of people are find revolting what he did. I was a little disturbed the other day on campus, I must admit, to see a young man wearing a number 7 Michael Vick t-shirt. Mm-hmm. Don't know quite what that means, but I suspect it's just stupidity and naivety on his part.
Yeah. The certainly, though, the length of the sentence does speak to our attitude towards animals. And, I mean, we wouldn't be satisfied with a year or two of jail term if he had committed this against a human being, with the killing of the dogs and all that sort of thing. And so the fact that we allow that sends a message to society that dogs' lives are just not as valuable as human beings' lives. They don't matter as much. Their life isn't as important. We can still treat them these ways. Whereas if there was a longer sentence, a much longer sentence, say something equivalent to what's done to human beings, that would certainly help to change the consciousness of society at large.
I mean, I guess it would, but I don't think it's very likely. And I do think most of us draw some kind of line between the value that we place on human lives of human beings, those who are very close to us. I mean, even, you know, those of us who have animals, who have dogs and cats, and who have experienced the death of those dogs and cats, we do tend to put that in a somewhat different context than the death of family and close friends. So, and of course, we live in a culture which permits people to kill and eat animals, and so I don't find it terribly surprising that we draw a line between animals and human beings in terms of the consequences of the misconduct. But again, I do find it somewhat heartening that over the last 30 years we've begun to recognize that animals deserve so much more respect than we have been giving them. And you know, certainly part of the movement towards vegetarianism is, I think, a reflection of that ideology.
Yeah, well said. Well, thank you very much for coming on the air today,
okay, well,
Neil.
Thank you.
And hopefully we'll have you on again in the future to comment.
You bet.
All right.
Thanks.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to CFRO 102.7 FM, Vancouver's co-op radio. The show is called Animal Voices. Over to you, Marge.
Thank you. Maybe we should just mention it was Dr. Neil Boyd, wasn't it? I believe he's a doctor at SFU University, Simon Fraser University.
I don't know if he's a doctor. I don't see that.
So with all the publications, et cetera, he probably is.
No, it could be. I don't see that on his bio. Oh,
I see. Okay. Now, I have a story that we have time to put forth right now, and it's called The Healing Touch. As a veterinarian making the journey from physical medicine to spiritual understanding, I found it was the animals who were my greatest teachers. I owe an especially large debt of thanks to an old gray tabby who was once brought into my practice for treatment. The old tabby's pelvis was fractured so badly that he couldn't stand. He had been sideswiped by a car, but luckily his fractures were such that they would heal naturally over time without an operation. Although he didn't appear to have any other injuries, it was critical that I keep him in the clinic for a few days just to be sure there was nothing else wrong. "You don't understand," his owner said pleadingly. "This cat is 17, and I have another one just like him at home. They were litter mates, and they've never been apart a day in their lives. You've got to let me bring him home." There was no way I could release that cat, no matter how emotionally wrenching the separation might be. Until he was able to stand and had bladder and bowel control, I had no choice but to keep him under observation. "I'm sorry," I said. "It's the best thing for the cat." By the next morning, I wasn't so sure. The tabby gazed into space with such a vacant look in his eyes that it seemed he had already given up and died. His vital signs were normal, but there was no life in him. He didn't meow, he didn't purr, he just lay there without eating, staring into some distant place where all hope was extinguished. As I pondered what to do next, the phone rang. It was the tabby's owner, and he was frantic. "My other cat's been screaming nonstop," he complained. "He never went to sleep, just prowled around searching and meowing. You have to do something." "I don't know if it will make a difference," I said, "but why don't you bring the other cat here?" The owner made it to the clinic in minutes. When he walked in with the other cat under his arm, I thought I was seeing double. The brother cat was the image of his litter mate, a fluffy pearl gray with stripes. But while his injured sibling lay in a cage torpid in depression, this one was taut with anxious energy. The minute I opened the cage door, the healing began. The electricity between the two cats was palpable. At the sight of his brother, the ailing cat's eyes brightened, his ears perked up, and he struggled in a futile effort to get up and draw near to him. But it was actual contact with his brother that really made the injured cat come alive. The healthy cat bounded into the cage, rushed up to his brother, meowing with joy, began licking and sniffing him all over. With the all-important physical link reestablished, the hurt cat mewed in response and, mustering all his strength, reciprocated by licking any part of his brother's body that brushed by him. A leg, a tail, an ear, a shoulder, all were touched by his tongue. The two cats couldn't seem to get enough of each other. They kept licking and cleaning and smelling, oblivious to anything but each other. They made it clear that for the rest of the clinic stay, they would be in the cage together. That night, I peeked into the cage and saw that the cats were still inseparable. They were huddled close together, purring in unison, as the brother cat encircled his hurt twin with the loving warmth of his body. After about 3 days, the hurt cat began to display normal body functions, which suggested he had no further significant internal injuries. By the fourth day, he was able to stand on his own with the help of his brother. The brother nudged him with his nose a few times, and the injured cat got the message. Haltingly, he struggled to his feet, leaning briefly against his brother's for support. A few seconds later, he stood proudly on his own and took a few wobbly steps. The next day, they went home. I didn't see them again for 2 years when they came in for a checkup. By then, they were 19 and still in good health. The injured cat had fully recovered and never showed any ill effects of the accident. It was clear that the old gray tabby's recovery resulted not from medical breakthrough or traditional veterinary science, but from the tender touch of a brother, a profound caring that had been transferred from one to the other through the touch of a tongue and the contact of warm fur. It was these physical acts of love that had brought the gift of life. And this little story is by Dr. Alan Schuon, who is a doctor of veterinarian science. Now, that relates up nicely, I think, to something that Allart told us about last week with the healing of the purr.
Yeah.
Now, the doctor doesn't mention the purring at all, mm-hmm. but that probably had a big influence on the healing of the cat.
Yeah, well, that's what that report had said, yeah.
Yeah.
Also, mm-hmm. I wanted mm-hmm. to let our listeners know, too, if they want to hear mm-hmm. any of the programs that we've done in the past, like the dog fighting story I referred to, or any of these programs, they can certainly go to our website, which is www.animalvoices.org, and those programs are there for you to download and listen to anytime. Did you want to add something? I have a quick cat joke here.
Okay, I have a joke as well, but you go ahead with okay, the cat well, joke. That's very appropriate.
Okay, so it says here that a newly discovered chapter in the book of Genesis has provided the answer to where do pets come from? Adam and Eve said, "Lord, when we were in the garden, you walked with us every day. Now we do not see you anymore. We are lonesome here, and it is difficult for us to remember how much you love us." And God said, "I will create a companion for you that will be with you and who will be a reflection of my love for you, and so that you will love me even when you cannot see me. Regardless of how selfish and childish or unlovable you may be, this new companion will accept you as you are and will love you as I do in spite of yourselves." And God created a new animal to be a companion for Adam and Eve, and it was a good animal, and God was pleased. And the new animal was pleased to be with Adam and Eve, and he wagged his tail. And Adam said, "Lord, I have already named all the animals in the kingdom, and I cannot think of a name for this new animal." And God said, "I have created this new animal to be a reflection of my love for you. His name will be a reflection of my own name, and you will call him Dog." And Dog lived with Adam and Eve and was a companion to them, and he loved them. And they were comforted, and God was pleased, and Dog was content and wagged his tail. After a while, it came to pass that an angel came to the Lord and said, "Lord, Adam and Eve have become filled with pride. They strut and preen like peacocks, and they believe that they are worthy of adoration. Dog has indeed taught them that they are loved, but perhaps too well." And God said, "I will create for them a companion who will be with them and who will see them as they are. The companion will remind them of their limitations, so they will know that they are not always worthy of adoration." And God created Cat to be a companion to Adam and Eve, and Cat would not obey them. And when Adam and Eve gazed into Cat's eyes, they were reminded that they were not the supreme beings. And Adam and Eve learned humility, and they were greatly improved, and God was pleased, and Dog was happy. And Cat didn't give a shit one way or the other.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Okay, now, we don't have time, actually, Marge.
But couldn't we just close off by thanking our listening audience for being with us and reminding them they are listening to CFRO 102.7 on their FM dial. Thank you for being with us today. Please be with us again next Friday, 12 o'clock noon.